The Laura Murphy Show, Episode 20.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. I am one of your hosts, Bob Murphy. With me, as always, is Carlos Lara. Carlos, how's it going?
I'm doing good, Bob.
Well, folks, we had a rocky couple of weeks here in the wake of the Brexit vote. In the latest issue of the Laura Murphy Report, which, of course, you should be looking at, and if you want to see more about it, just go to our website, laramurphy.com. That's L-A-R-A hyphen Murphy, M-U-R-P-H-Y.com. And there's a lot of sample articles and issues of the Laura Murphy Report. If you like what you hear on this podcast, the print version of the Laura Murphy Report, it's got much more detail. But in the latest issue of that, we do a lot of coverage of Brexit, which is short for British exit, leave the people in Great Britain voting to leave the European Union or the EU. And we thought for the podcast, we might as well condense some of that material and give you the news you can use, some of the big picture points we were making, because unfortunately, a lot of the coverage of this issue, in our opinion, is just focusing on sort of irrelevant details and missing some of the key principles. So perhaps I'll just start to make sure you folks have the context of this. So after World War II, there were lots of various organizations and efforts underway to try to make sure something that awful didn't happen again, right? So there was this drive to what can we do to promote peace and harmony and commerce among European nations. So there were things that you're quite familiar with, NATO, the United Nations, and so on. But there were also European-specific organizations such as the European Atomic Energy Community, and then what at that time was called the European Economic Community, or the EEC. And so the United Kingdom joined the EEC in 1973. So that's why if you're seeing in news reports now that, oh my goodness, is Great Britain really going to end its 43-year history in the EU, that's what they're talking about. Because the EU itself was not actually formed until the 1992 Maastricht Treaty, which formed that. The treaty, I think, kicked in 93, all right? And it was also that treaty that formally created the euro as a currency unit. And so that replaced eventually the more familiar traditional European currencies that you may remember, like the German mark, the French franc, and so forth. One last bit of clarification, because I was talking to some people who were confused about this. The EU is not the same thing as the group of countries using the euro as a currency. All right, and it goes both ways. So you could be a country in the EU and still not have the euro as a currency. So Great Britain, for example, still retained the pound. Other examples would be Denmark and Sweden. They are members of the EU, but they do not use the euro as their currencies. And then it even goes the other way. For example, Kosovo technically uses the euro as its currency, even though it is not a member of the EU. Now, that's kind of a weird case because their own currency, they hyperinflated it away. It collapsed during the war against Serbia. And so then they started using the German mark. And so then when Germany switched over to the euro, that they went along as well. And then officially what happened is on June 23rd, 2016, the British public voted in a referendum that said, quote, should the UK remain a member of the European Union or leave the European Union? Going up to that, most people were quite sure that the Remain vote would win handily, and that's, of course, what all the elite public opinion leaders thought and so forth. And so it was shocking when it turned out that the last I checked, the official tally was 51.9% voted to leave and only 48.1% voted to remain. And since then, markets were bouncing around like crazy. They've stabilized somewhat in the wake of that vote, but people are still trying to sort things out. So I will stop at this point and hand the mic over to Carlos if you want to comment at this stage.
Okay, well, I'm thinking how best to enter this particular conversation on Brexit, Bob, because it was actually you that wrote the article in the LMR about it, which explained a lot of the things that you are explaining right now, going into some of this background. I think at this particular point, I think I would like to say that obviously this was a major turn of events. That the vote coming from the people was to leave the EU. And I remember very distinctly there was no significant changes in the stock market, leading. And then all of a sudden they had that vote. And all of a sudden the stock market here in the United States started really seen some significant changes, and of course, it all had to do with Brexit. I don't think it's incorrect to say that so many of us were caught by surprise, not even knowing what Brexit was until it finally did happen. And it's been so commingled with, just the whole political scene that's been going on. And so much of it, the underpinnings of it seemed to be that it was all about racism for those that were trying to keep the UK in the Eurozone, and the folks that were trying to get out of it, that was their main agenda. And then if you remember, there was this member of parliament that was for the UK staying in that was shot and killed the day before the first vote was there. So there's a lot of things that were going on there, making this whole situation quite troublesome, worldwide all of a sudden. So the vote coming in the way they did was quite amazing, I think, for a lot of people. And I think a lot of people were confused and wanted to find out, what does this all mean? What exactly is behind it all? And so I think I'm going to stop there and let you keep, building on what you've discovered and on this entire story.
Well, sure. So I think that you have a good tie-in there, that you're right, Carlos. The elite opinion leaders and the people in major investment banks and so on, and a lot of the public officials in the United States and elsewhere just assumed everything was going to be fine. And you're right. They tried to paint this narrative where the people who wanted to leave were just a bunch of xenophobes, and it's because they're against world harmony, and they just want to stick their heads in the sands, and they don't like the rest of Europe and so on. And it's that kind of attitude that, in this day and age, can't we move beyond that? And that sort of thing that plunged us into chaos before. So I think it's important for people to understand, that connection. And that's why people are trying to link the Brexit vote to, for example, the Donald Trump campaign, because people see obvious, at least superficial similarities between the things they're worrying about. And it falls, breaks down according to the same traditional divide that you see in U.S. politics, where people support Trump for various reasons, and his critics obviously can point to some of the more inflammatory things he said and say, oh, yeah, it's just anybody who supports this guy, it's got to be because basically you don't like Mexicans or whatever. And so similarly, same thing happening over in Great Britain. I think that is a bit simplistic for a lot of the people who are concerned about that. I don't have any specific statistics to give you, but when I was over there recently giving some talks in Eastern Europe, I was talking to people there who were, classically liberal. I mean, that's the kind of speaking tour I would be going on, as you can imagine, giving talks about free market economics from place to place. And the people we were traveling with were all classical liberal, quite libertarian in U.S. terminology, and very cosmopolitan, spoke several languages, traveled all over Europe and so forth. And some of them were even telling me that, with this Syrian refugee crisis, it's really amazing some of the position a lot of these governments are finding themselves in, where because of the rules of the EU, you can't really have your own government setting up its own policies for border control. And so you have this odd situation where if just one country is liberal and letting people in from outside, then, you know, they can travel freely. And so you have these situations where the country that has the most generous welfare benefits and so forth for people who show up there are getting overwhelmed because of people who got into Europe through some other country. And then they can't legally stop them, or they'd have to revise their own policy. So it's things like that that were behind a lot of the vote, I'm sure. But I think it was also just more generally this angst of, you know, and we in the LMR issue that I the article I wrote going through, there's lots of more specific, narrowly economic rationales in terms of British political figures saying, look, we don't have sovereignty over these things, that we're having our businesses have to comply with regulations coming at us from Brussels. And, you know, these aren't even bureaucrats for the EU that we have the ability to recall, right? It's not even. So an analogy you might use is to say that, for example, officials in the Texas government might say, we have to, our people here have to comply with regulations from the EPA or the SEC and pay taxes, of course, according to what the IRS says. But at least there, the people who live in Texas get to vote on the U.S. president, and they have some representation in the U.S. Congress, whereas the situation is even less symmetrical in the EU, where people in Great Britain were subject to these rules, and yet they couldn't directly even vote. And there's multiple presidents of the EU, right? So the system is just very odd from an American perspective. And so these were some of the things behind, if you go and actually read the statements of the people who were for, you know, who wanted to pull out of that. So it's, you're right, Carlos, a lot of high tempers. Let me say one other thing too, that after the vote, which shocked everybody, as we said, there was this attempt to make it look like, oh, the people voting to leave, as Carlos has pointed out, either say, oh yeah, they're just a bunch of racists and xenophobes, or to say they were complete fools, just completely ignorant. They didn't even know what they were doing. And one example of that that kind of backfired and embarrassed the people who put it out was that immediately after the vote, there was this story that ran saying, you know, major media picked it up saying, ha, after hours after voting to leave the EU, British voters frantically Google to find out what the EU is. You know, the headline was something like that. And you read the story and it says, oh, Google Trends has reported, or if you go look this up on Google Trends, you'll see people typing into Google, what is the EU, from computers that were in Great Britain, that those search terms or whatever spiked right after the vote. So leading you to believe the whole, you know, point of the story was to say these idiots, a lot of the people who voted in this referendum to leave, didn't even really know what it was. And so it turned out, though, people dug a little deeper, and it was about 1,000 people total in all of Great Britain that typed it into their thing. So that number was not in the original news story. The news story just talked about, you know, it showed a graph, but you didn't see the, you know, any units on the graph, so you didn't know what this was, you know, in terms of how many actual people. And for all we know, it was people who didn't vote in the referendum. And then, you know, the markets are down the next day, everyone's going nuts. You can imagine a lot of people saying, what the heck is this? And they go to the, you know, type in things like, what is the EU? So that's just one example. There, I saw another story saying, oh, after voting to leave, many Brits are now regretting their decision. And it literally interviewed, the story I saw literally interviewed one person who said, yeah, in the referendum yesterday, I voted to leave, but now I wish I hadn't. And people in my family feel the same way.
Right.
So, I mean, again, I'm not saying there was only one person who felt that way in all of Great Britain, but my point is it was clear that the major media did not like this result, and so then went to work to make it look like only a bunch of evil people or idiots could have voted this way, and what's ironic, besides just being, I think, dishonest, the people who voted that way did so for various reasons, and if you just keep wagging your finger at them and saying, oh, you're an evil person, bad, 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 that's not going to make them all of a sudden say, oh, gee, I didn't think of it like that. You're right. I'm going to change my mind. That just, you know, feeds the fire, if it will. It makes them think, yeah, the elites don't get this, and we got to take back, you know, power to the people and take our country back. That just, it just makes it worse. So in addition, again, to being dishonest reporting, stuff like that, I think, just makes the situation worse.
Right. And, you know, if you just use the rule of thumb of following the money and where it takes you, and clearly, if we use the the so-called 1% or the financial elite that's very closely connected to government and big media. Obviously, that's going to represent one side of thinking on this Brexit thing. And then you're going to have the other side, which is the people, you know, down at the you and me level, and what their very strong feelings are about what's going on. They may not know all of the details, but it clearly it's the feelings that the situation is, doesn't look like it's going to help them in any way, you know, to keep staying in the EU. So it wasn't so much, from what I could gather, a racist thing from the people's standpoint. It was more like a cultural defense. I mean, I think a lot of them felt that they were literally being invaded. It was like an invasion. And they were being told that having all these immigrants come inside their borders were somehow going to contribute more, you know, to the UK than they would absorb in social payments to these immigrants. And I think the people were thinking there was major inconsistency in that because they weren't really experiencing that for themselves. So it was almost like a renouncing of all of that, you know, when they voted the way that they did.
Yeah, that is, as we say, lots of difficult social and cultural issues here to sort out. In this issue of immigration, I mean, this divides even libertarian in terms of political theory, people who endorse Austrian economics, even with the, you know, my colleagues and so on are sharply divided on this stuff in the U.S. context. So it's not an easy issue to solve. We're certainly not going to try to solve that in this particular podcast. I think, though, what we can speak more definitively on is the issue of free trade, you know, in the movement of goods. And here it's ironic because the main objection to Brexit from an economic standpoint was to say, oh my gosh, the British people here are out of their foolishness. They're shooting themselves in the foot because by leaving the EU, now they're going to lose access to the European markets, right? So that was one of the reasons why a country might want to join the EU, is that then there would be no tariff barriers. So it's just like in the United States, you have a free trade zone within the United States among each individual state, and that's one of the reasons that the U.S. is so wealthy. By the same token, then the part of the vision of the EU was to say, hey, why don't we try to do for ourselves what the US have going on over there? And so we'll have a free trade zone internally. And so the concern is, oh, now if Great Britain leaves, that makes it possible the EU can put up tariff barriers. And so the Great Britain's trade with the rest of Europe on the continent can be diminished. So there, even taking the standard models at face value, somebody like Paul Krugman, who was an opponent of Brexit, right? So he has no reason to downplay the figure, said that maybe in the long run, that would mean that Great Britain, its real income would be 2% lower than it otherwise would have been. So that, I mean, that's not chump change. That's a decent hit. But in terms of the world, it's not a big deal at all, right? Just the fact that Great Britain's people would be maybe 2%, have a 2% lower in real income. And then the people in Europe also would be slightly poorer as a result of the diminished trade opportunities. But in terms of, you know, should people in the United States be affected by that, or people in China care? That's a drop in the bucket compared to the global GDP. So that's, you know, in terms of the fundamentals, there's no reason this vote should have had such a big influence. And then furthermore, we shouldn't just stipulate that as a done deal, that if you think about it, there's nothing, there's, you know, it's not written anywhere that the people in the EU have to punish the British for leaving by levying retaliatory tariffs. I mean, that makes the people in Europe poorer also, the people in the continent poorer, right? Tariffs, if you put up tariff barriers against another country's exports, you don't just hurt the people in that country, you hurt your own people, right? So the case for free trade, the classical case is developed by Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and so on. It's unilateral, meaning it doesn't matter what the rest of the world does. When your government lowers tariff barriers, your own people benefit. They benefit even more if other countries reciprocate, but a tariff is, one way to think about it, is a tax on your people. You're telling your people, we're going to make it artificially more expensive for you to import stuff from foreign manufacturers. So that doesn't make your people better off to restrict their options and artificially make certain things more expensive. So if the people in the EU want to punish the British for leaving and make an example of them, they can legally, but there's no reason they ought to do that. It makes them poorer. And so even these figures that try to assess the impact of Brexit that rely on back of the envelope calculations as to restricted trade with Europe, with the rest of Europe, they're just assuming that the rest of the Europeans have to do that. And they don't. Let me give you an example. So, Switzerland's not in the EU. The United States is not in the EU. And yet they have plenty of trade with the people in those countries. So this idea that because Great Britain wants to sever its formal political ties with the other European governments in this entity known as the EU, and that somehow is a blow against free trade and a move towards, autarky and closing off yourself to foreign imports and so on, that doesn't follow at all. In fact, part of the reason the people in Great Britain, some of them, wanted to leave was because they wanted to have the ability to negotiate bilateral trade agreements with other countries. And if they had stayed in the EU, they wouldn't be able to. So there's an argument to be made that 10 years from now, Great Britain will have relatively freer trade with a larger percentage of the world than it would be if it remained in the EU. So again, this idea that it's automatic that this must restrict trade, that's not the fault of the British. If it's not an argument. I'll end with this and turn it back over to you, Carlos. It's an odd argument to be saying because the people remaining in the EU might retaliate and levy taxes that even make the people in the EU poorer, the British, should be ashamed of themselves for voting to leave and then causing the world financial markets to go haywire. I mean, that's a weird argument to make.
Right. So, Bob, for sure, you're talking about free trade here, and I hope you come back and talk a little bit more about free trade, especially the way Mises presented it in his speech to Argentina back in 1958, because I think that makes a great, great point into what he was trying to say, because we really don't have free trade going on in any country right now. But if you'll allow me just a little bit more and just sort of ask the question, how would New York Wall Street and big banks feel about the UK coming out of the EU? How would Washington feel about it? Would they be for it or against it? And it's a good question to ask because, when I follow down that train of thought, again, I'm thinking about following the money here, I would think that both the big banks and Wall Street, would want to see the UK, come into and stay in the EU, keeping in mind that one of the privileges that the UK had was to keep its own currency and also its central bank. And so they had something that Greece and Portugal and Spain, Italy, France, Germany, those kind of countries in the EU did not have. So they are all under one central bank. And I keep thinking that the New York banks, because they would see the UK as a major competitor, as a financial center, would like to more or less eliminate that, I would say. And obviously, the EU, represents a cluster of countries, again, coming out of World War II, that, formulated much of NATO. And so I'm thinking that Washington is maybe worried now that other countries may follow and leave the EU, and then there would go NATO. And I think Washington's very interested in making sure that NATO is kept intact. So I'm exploring there the idea that if I had to bank on how New York banks and Wall Street feel about the UK either staying or leaving, as well as Washington, I would say that they'd be hoping that the UK would have stayed in for sure, because it would just move closer to that, you know, that centralized sort of government in one area all across Europe.
Yeah, I think you're right. You raise a lot of good points there, Carlos. So as far as Mises goes, the context here, folks, is Carlos found this speech that Mises had given, believe in Argentina in 1958, where it was part of a lecture series, and he was explaining to them, and it's amazing how relevant it is today. So I was glad when Carlos dug that up. Because Mises is acknowledging, he says that, yeah, if the United States got rid of its migration barriers, there would be millions of people flocking in there year after year, and that would affect the wage rates of people already in the United States and so on. And so he acknowledges that there's issues there. And he said, but I think he wisely said, look, I'm not going to talk about immigration policy, though. What I am going to say is, you know, why are these disparities? Why is it that U.S. workers have such a higher level of pay than workers in other parts of the world? And he says, because the capital per worker is much higher in the United States, right? So it's not just that, oh, they go to better schools or something, or they have a better work ethic. It's that U.S. workers have more tools and equipment augmenting their bare hands compared to other parts of the world. And so he's saying that ultimately, the way the rest of the world is going to catch up to that, so there's not, you know, all these millions of people who are lined up on the border trying to get into the U.S., is for the capital per worker to rise in these other countries. And he said, historically, this was achieved through foreign investment, that, you know, in the golden age of the British Empire, of classical free trade and so on, that capital was flowing into all these regions of the world and greatly accelerating what the local people domestically could save and invest. You'd have, you know, foreign capitalists sending in capital. But he's telling the people in Argentina that if the governments of these regions now, if they pass measures that expropriate the foreign investors, well, then they're not going to keep sending capital in. So he's saying, you know, you don't have the ability to change the immigration policies of other nations, but what you can certainly do is not engage in inflation or confiscatory taxes, or, you know, just outright seizing of property, or doing currency controls and things like that that make foreign investors regret having put money and capital into your own country, that you want to have a nice stable climate, the rule of law and so on, so that, you know, the local judges aren't corrupt and will rule against the foreign businesses and so on, so that foreigners from these rich areas want to send their capital into your country, and that will raise the productivity and wages of people domestically. So there won't be all these people desperate to leave and to go elsewhere. So that, you know, great wisdom from Mises decades ago, and it's still relevant today.
Yeah. And if I may interject there, Bob, before mm-hmm. we forget this part, he was very, very quick to point out that foreign investment was sort of a new thing that sprung up in the 19th century. And he points out that the British, who were even ahead of the United States beforehand, when they began foreign investments, they put a lot of capital into the United States. And that he was stating that our railroads were actually built on British capital. And so he did point to foreign investments being the real stimulus to get other countries to come on board and raise their standard of living. But he said that when it first started, it was a capitalist making investments with other capitalists in foreign countries. And then all of a sudden it changed to capitalists making investments with governments, and they never dreamed that governments would confiscate, you know, their capital and never pay it back. And then on top of that, as you said a while ago, begin taxing foreign investments the way they do now. And so at that point, we see that taxes really are choking out the ability not only for corporations to actually save money and invest in capital simply because of the horrendous taxation that's on corporations and governments place on foreign investments today.
Yeah, exactly. It really is amazing. With a lot of this stuff that, yes, there's other concerns you can bring, and we want to ask, you know, why are some regions so poor? And clearly there's issues of history and colonialism and things like that. But a lot of things, you know, are because of the policies pursued by domestic governments is to explain, you know, why is it that these people are stuck in this rut? As far as your other question, Carlos, or your observation, yeah, I think it's entirely correct to say that the major investment banks and major governments of the world were quite alarmed by this Brexit vote. And I think for obvious reasons, as far as the governments are concerned, that, you know, just the splintering up of power when one group breaks away from another, they don't like that, right? That if you're the political system, you know, it has this natural ingrown tendency to amass power, to centralize. You see it in the United States. That's the example I'm most familiar with, that it's, you know, not merely the decline of federalism, right? So that the distribution between what states have authority over versus the federal government, that has certainly shifted over the decades heavily in favor of Washington, D.C. at the expense of the states. But then even within the federal level itself, there used to be a much greater division of power among the three branches. And of course, lately, that's been more and more centralized in the executive. So you do see this natural tendency. And then when some group of people, you know, have the villagers get upset and so on, and they vote to break away, that's certainly going to upset the plans for continued centralization of power and alarm the people who are sort of in control of those systems. As far as the bankers, investment banks, and so on, I mean, there's lots of things going on, but I think clearly one of the issues, as you say, Carlos, is they're concerned, well, wait a minute, if Great Britain leaves, are other countries going to start leaving? And there are a lot of problems with many banks in the EU countries right now, and they're only being kept afloat because of the ECB and other sort of bailout programs that the governments have all agreed to in the past, bailout packages and whatnot. And so if some of the stronger countries start breaking away, saying, you know what, why are we getting dragged down by these other people? Then, you know, the problem is, well, these banks might be stuck there, and then the banks are going to eat all those bad loans. Just to give you one example, the most prominent one, now the news has shifted away from Brexit per se, and lots of people in the financial press are looking at Italy. Just to give you one shocking statistic, the latest figures coming out are showing that fully 17% of the loans in Italian banks are non-performing. And so you say, well, I don't know, is that good or bad? Well, in the U.S., the figure of non-performing loans was like 5% at the height of the financial crisis, right? So for 17% to be non-performing in Italian banks right now, that's a pretty shocking figure. And so, I mean, that's just to give you some indication of how things are there. So as we wrap up this episode, I want to just summarize what my personal view is, and I'll then let you do the same, Carlos, that there's no reason in terms of, quote, the fundamentals that this Brexit vote should have any major impact on prosperity in the global sense, because it doesn't even need to harm or hinder trade between Great Britain and the rest of the European continent, because again, the EU countries could just say, all right, well, we believe in self-determination. If you guys don't want to be part of our club, go ahead. We still want to trade with you, right? So it's odd, this mindset that it's the British who are being sore losers and taking their marbles and walking away. No, they still want to have trade. I mean, look at Farage's speech, you know, his sort of victory dance. He was being a bit of a jerk, some might argue, and gloating, but he was telling the Europeans that, hey, okay, we voted. I want to trigger Article 50. I think we should do this in an expeditious manner. And hey, we have every reason to want to continue trading with you guys. You don't want to block trade with us. That's going to hurt your own manufacturers. And so let's now work on having trade agreements, right? So it's not that the British are saying we don't want to have commerce with other European nations. They were just talking about political ties and losing their sovereignty. So there's no reason that needs to affect it. However, it doesn't surprise me of how volatile the financial sector is in light of this, because Carlos and I have been warning for years that the major central banks of the world have blown up a giant asset bubble, and that the banks, especially in Europe, made a bunch of stupid decisions that have just been papered over electronically since 2008. And so they haven't solved those problems. They just pumped in a bunch of liquidity and pushed the problems elsewhere and make the problems come back later, and they're going to fester and be even worse. So if there is a major crisis 6 months from now, that's going to be consistent with what we've said. And people might blame Brexit for it, but that's silly. That really the problem is this whole system has been built on a house of cards in the last several years. And so it, any kind of spark could make it come down. So on that happy note, I will stop and turn it over to you, Carlos, for the final word.
Well, I just want to more or less echo what you just said, Bob. You know, I guess we should say that maybe the Brexit deal isn't a done deal yet. You know, maybe something's going to come up yet where they're going to finally agree that is the vote. And we'll have to see what really happens there. But really, aside from the problem of inflation, which is very, very severe, and we've talked about it a lot in other podcasts and other Laura Murphy Report articles. Aside from that, the only strategy for more economic equality in our country and in the world is for industrialization or foreign investments. You know, we really can't get away from that. And then that this is only possible through increased savings. You know, that's really the starting point. And these savings, you know, get invested in capital accumulation and in capital investments. And that there's really no shortcuts to that. There's no easy way around it. I mean, those are the steps right there. And in order to accomplish that, we have to put in the time and the hard work in getting that done.
Yep, the Austrian message is that the key to prosperity is to live below your means and save, and you don't want your government taking steps to sabotage that process or to debase the currency. So it might be boring to some people, but the benefit is it works. That's all the time we have for this episode. Thanks everyone for tuning in, and remember to share the podcast with your friends and colleagues who might be interested in hearing commentary on the financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.
You've just finished another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LauraMurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.